Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nimi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk about interspecies relationships with Jennifer Holland, senior writer for National Geographic magazine and author of Unlikely Friendships, a new book that details 47 remarkable stories from the animal kingdom. Jennifer Holland is a senior writer for National Geographic magazine. After finishing her bachelor's degree in English with a journalism emphasis at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1991, Jennifer worked as a coordinator and writer for a scientific magazine called the Journal of NIH Research, in addition to writing freelance articles for Destination Discovery, the Learning Channel Monthly, and Discovery Channel Online. She returned to school in 1997 and completed an MS in Sustainable Development and Conservation Biology in 1998 at the University of Maryland, College Park. During her schooling, she was an assistant director of the university's Writing Center, where she tutored undergraduate students and taught a course on writing and tutoring techniques. She then spent 2 years as a researcher at National Geographic Television and finally moved to the editorial department at National Geographic Magazine, where, a decade later, she remains with the magazine as a senior staff writer with a focus on science and natural history. At National Geographic Magazine, she's focused on subjects such as amphibian declines, pollinator conservation, the state of the Great Barrier Reef, the geology and beauty of Hawaiian volcanoes, microscopic life under the Arctic ice, and the medicinal properties of reptile venom. In her role as a writer and reporter, she has traveled to a dozen countries and has risked it all, flying in zero gravity over the Gulf of Mexico, scuba diving with tiger sharks, climbing the tallest tree in Costa Rica, and camping out with bushmen in the forest of Papua New Guinea. Her most recent project is a new book released in July 2011 from Workman Publishing called Unlikely Friendships. Unlikely Friendships documents one heartwarming tale after another of animals who bond in the most unexpected ways. Today you'll hear about a cat and a bird, a dog and a fish, and an elephant and a sheep. While many of the relationships provide comfort, that's not always the case. For instance, I couldn't help but laugh when I pictured a troublesome pygmy goat teaching his friend, a pet hippo, yes, you heard that right, to escape their enclosure. You'll also hear some curious stories of predators befriending their prey, like a lioness who mothered a series of aurochs, or the leopard in India who would slip into a village every night to sleep with a cow. That single leopard changed the attitudes of villagers toward these large cats. You'll also hear some truly remarkable encounters between humans and marine animals in the wild, like how a female leopard seal took a photographer under its wing, or fin as it were. She even brought the photographer penguins and got exasperated when he couldn't or wouldn't kill it or eat it. And of course, you'll hear some interesting stories that never made it into her book. When I talked to Jennifer, I started by asking her how she came to write a book about unlikely friendships between animal species.
Well, I think one of the things that drew me to the subject was the popularity of these kinds of stories. You know, a lot of people come across them on the web. They're always in your inbox. Everyone is always responding to them in such a positive way. And it just seemed that, especially at a time when there's so much negative and angst in the world, and to look for something that has a lot of joy behind it and to present something that makes people feel good would be a really nice project to do. And so that, I think that's sort of what got me excited about the idea of bringing all of these stories together in a book.
How did you find stories about these unlikely friendships?
They came to me a lot of ways. Some of them were just ones that people had passed along and that will be, I think, familiar to readers. But then I put out sort of the word to friends and family and on some listservs and things that deal with wildlife or with captive animals. And I just said, you know, if you've heard of anything like this or if you've encountered something that might fit into this category, let me know. And then for all of the stories, regardless of whether they've been told on the web somewhere before, I tracked down the original source of the story, whether that was a pet owner or a conservation director or a photographer or whoever it was, and tried to get sort of the backstory, make sure that I really knew how it all happened, what the significance might be, you know, what the context was, and just retell the story and really just get it out there and find out what really happened.
Do you have a favorite unlikely friendship?
You know, they're so different. I think there are a few that I like for very different reasons. There's a story about the cheetahs and the Anatolian shepherds, the dogs. And I think what I really like about that story is that there's this neat conservation angle to it, and then there's kind of a twist. So you have these animals that in Namibia, where cheetahs are a problem animal, and where farmers, you know, are tempted to shoot at them to keep them away from livestock, they found that these dogs were very good at chasing away the cheetahs, just keeping them at bay. But then here in the States, and I think at some zoos in other countries as well, they found that the shepherds were also very good at befriending the cheetahs and becoming sort of stress reducers for them in a captive situation. So that was an interesting story for me as a conservation biologist, just to sort of see these different pieces to the story. But then just sort of on a fun level, there's an iguana and a cat. You know, iguanas are not usually very sporting animals. They can be very aggressive. And so to see an iguana that cuddles up with a cat and allows it to lick it and share its food and play with its tail and things like that, I think some of, you know, stories like that are just funny and endearing and inspiring, and so I enjoy those as well.
Yeah, I had wanted to talk to you about the cheetah story. I've heard a lot about the Cheetah Conservation Fund offering dogs to farmers to basically guard their flocks.
Right,
and
right.
I'm wondering if you could give us some of the backstory about what the issue is with cheetahs in Namibia. You were saying that they are going after livestock. Why is that?
I think, you know, this is one of those cases where, which I think is fairly common in many parts of Africa and elsewhere, where you have, you know, wild animals coming up against human development, and you have these farms that are maybe taking over areas where cheetahs used to roam, and there's this overlap of wildlife and human. And the cheetahs, you know, may be losing some of their natural prey because of this situation, and so they're in search of food. They're hungry. And these livestock are pretty easy pickings for them. And so I think that they're coming into contact with livestock and occasionally killing them. And the farmers, understandably, are trying to protect this very important resource, this valuable resource. And so it's not really a question of the people are bad, the cheetahs are good, anything like that. It's really just how can you manage this situation to avoid anybody having a big loss. You don't want cheetahs being shot, and you also don't want farmers to be losing their resources.
And cheetahs are an endangered species that are very hard pressed to reproduce well.
Yes, they've always had problems. They, at some point, I think, had a bottleneck in terms of their genetics. They've always been relatively rare, I think, in the big cat world. So in particular, among the big cats, I think cheetahs are ones that need this sort of extra protection and extra care.
What happens with the dogs? The Cheetah Conservation Fund provides these Anatolian shepherds. Why Anatolian shepherds?
From my understanding, they're just really good personalities for serving as sort of these go-between or stand-betweens. I'm not sure the correct word for it, but they will chase away the cheetahs. They're protective of whatever it is they're supposed to be protecting. And I think in this case, they're trained to be with the livestock. They know the livestock, and that's the thing that they're protecting. And they're trained to just make sure that these cheetahs stay back. And it gives, you know, it's a wonderful incentive to, you know, for the farmers to leave the cheetahs alone, because they feel confident that they're not going to have a problem with the cheetahs. Whereas in the zoo situation, the shepherds are trained to be the cheetah's protector instead. And so they and they really do befriend them. I mean, that's really how it was described to me. They are physically present for the cheetahs most of the time. They will, you know, cuddle with the cheetahs, they'll sleep next to the cheetahs, they'll, you know, just be there for them. And cheetahs can be very easily stressed out. They're sort of fragile, I think, in terms of their emotion. And so in a captive situation, they really sort of need to be calmed. And the dogs seem to provide that for them. It's a very interesting combination of animals.
Interesting, because dogs work for humans in calming us.
Yes, right, exactly. I think it's a similar thing.
So for that emotionally fragile cheetah. And do they become friends? I mean, like, you'd think in one swipe of a paw, the cheetah could kill the dog. Why don't they?
Well, you know, I think maybe they understand that this is, you know, that this is a beneficial relationship in some way, and it does just bring them some sort of comfort to have these companions there protecting them or just sort of watching over them in a sense. And so I have not heard of any kind of aggression between the animals at all. They do separate them for eating, which is probably to avoid any aggression because certainly they that would be the time that you might see it. But they just they become part of each other's lives, and once two animals are paired up, they stay that way for the remainder of the lives of the animals.
Do you know if the shepherds have had any impact on breeding success for cheetahs, like calming them down enough that
they're breeding them better?
They're breeding better within zoos.
You know, I don't know the answer to that. That's an excellent question, and I should pursue that, but I'm afraid I can't answer that one.
Well, we'll provide an update then.
There we go. Yeah, very good question. I should have found that out.
What? And now you mentioned an iguana and a cat. Now, iguanas, I personally do not think of iguanas as particularly cuddly.
No, not at all. Not at all.
So what is their normal personality?
An adult. It is a funny story, really, because the woman who owns the animals is a big animal rescue type, and she's brought many animals into her apartment in New York City. Not the place you expect this zoo to live, but she rescued the iguana literally from the streets of New York. Somebody saw it. Someone must have.
And now that's a good phrase. I rescued the iguana from the streets
from
of New York.
New York. Yeah, it was at 71st and 13th Avenue in Brooklyn. If I remember correctly. And so she brought it home and didn't really know much about iguanas at the time, but she did the research and she had rescue cats as well. And
the iguana was just wandering around?
It was, yeah. I think that what probably happened was someone had gotten it as a little teeny iguana when they're really cute and sweet, and then as it grew up and became more aggressive and became sexually mature and suddenly was having is not as nice to be around, and unfortunately I guess some pet owners just don't know what to do, so they just let them go. Not an ideal situation in any way, but fortunately
right, but not uncommon that it happens.
Probably not. Yeah, you don't see them too often, but
maybe not on 71st and 13th.
Right.
So she brought it home, and she already had a lot of cats.
Yeah, she had a number of cats, and she, I don't recall exactly sort of what brought them together in the first place. I think it was probably food. I think that or warmth, because the iguana's tank, you know, there's always like a heat lamp there, and I think we all know that cats like to sprawl out under any sort of heat source. So I think that between food and sunshine, the cat kind of crept into the cage with the iguana, and the iguana didn't seem to mind. And over time, the two became pals. And the cat would become physical with the iguana, would lick it, would chew its feet, would play with its tail. And, you know, I wouldn't say the iguana would hug the cat or anything dramatic like that, but it would certainly tolerate and seem to enjoy in some way the attention from the cat. So not what you would expect from an iguana in any situation. But they share food. There's a great picture in the book of them eating from the same plate, and no aggression. And I think the cat is, you know, stays away from the iguana if he's in a mood. you know, the way Rena, the owner, described it. You know, they do, iguanas do become aggressive when they're sexually mature. And she said that, that her cat will just kind of back off and give him a break from the friendship for a little while until he's back to normal.
So when it's that time of the...
Yes, time of the month.
Well, we can learn a lot from that cat.
Exactly.
Now, some of your stories revolve around elephants.
Yes, always. I think elephants are so fascinating, and so when you're looking at animal emotion, I think that many people have heard the stories about elephants and how they are known to mourn their dead, and the way the matriarch, you know, sort of takes care of all the elephants and their movements together. And they really are incredible animals and incredibly smart animals and emotional. And so these pairings of, say, an elephant and a dog in some ways aren't as surprising, just because I think it's easier for humans to understand a dog needing a friend and maybe an elephant needing a friend than something like an iguana. But the one of the elephant and the dog story is one that I think people will say, oh, I think I've heard something about that before, because it just became a sensation, because it was just such an incredible true friendship between this huge beast and this small stray dog that just kind of happened upon this animal sanctuary.
And tell me, where was that?
This was a sanctuary in Tennessee. It's called the Elephant Sanctuary. And stray dogs, I think, are common on the property, but this was just a particular companionship that became really well known there.
And that elephant sanctuary, it rescues what kind of elephants?
I believe that they take in, they probably have some sort of circus elephant types and elephants from zoos that haven't done well elsewhere. I think it's really a mix of animals that come there. But the elephants also, of course, become friendly with one another and sort of find common ground with their own kind. But that was one of the interesting things in this case, was that the elephant seemed more interested in the dog than in the other elephants.
Why do you think that might be? less emotion, maybe. I love you no matter what, says the dog.
Exactly.
Because the elephants, I have done another episode that was related, looking at elephant trauma. A lot of those elephants at that facility have experienced some sort of trauma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This one, I don't know if there was a trauma. I do know that there was, that the elephant had sort of grown up with a whole mix of types of animals, and that I talked to an elephant expert, Joyce Poole, about it a little bit, and she said she felt that there had just kind of been a shifting of attachment from one animal to another. And so the elephant, who had had sort of this unusual exposure to many different species, was accepting of them and drawn to them. And so for whatever reason, this particular dog became served that purpose for the elephant, that attachment.
You talked about another elephant that bonded with a sheep named Albert. And that was in South Africa, yeah?
Yes. This was in Eastern Cape at a wildlife rehabilitation center. And this was a story where there was an elephant that had lost its mother. Very sad story. It was a critical time for the elephant to be bonding with its mother. And so the staff at the wildlife center wanted to make sure that the elephant had a close bond with another animal. And the sheep, I think they chose the sheep because they're really quite intelligent, and they do get along well with all kinds of animals. This was not something where they expected any kind of aggression or problem. And yet, actually, I think it turned out that there was a lot of chasing in the beginning. The elephant wasn't too sure about this friendship. It didn't go well right in the beginning, and it took a little bit of time before the two started to kind of pal around together, feed together, and eventually really became inseparable. The elephant would walk around with his trunk on the sheep's back, and they would feed off the same tree and were even eating the same kinds of foods, even though normally they would would eat separate species of leaf.
And that I found remarkable. And I guess maybe, you know, to me, of course, I'm anthropomorphizing it, you know, that, oh, if someone I love wants me to try something new, I'll give it a go.
Exactly. I don't really like mussels or clams, but I'll taste one because, you know, my husband wants me to. Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, there may be some imitation there, or maybe there's something a little deeper going on. Who can say? That's part of what's so interesting about the stories is we really don't know, you know, what's really, really going on between the animals. But it's a lot of fun to speculate.
Now, the elephant became ill and died.
Yes.
So, and what I was curious about and what struck me about that particular story was that it seemed to be something special about Albert, because you mentioned that afterwards he was befriending other types of animals like zebras and whatnot. So I was wondering if there was something special about Albert or about sheep in general.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting that he sort of, you know, continued this interspecies acceptance or relationships with other species after the fact. Perhaps it was just a matter of wanting companionship, whatever that companionship looked like. But I know, I mean, sheep are really, really interesting, and they are very, very smart. And I think that people don't give them much credit, because out standing in the field, they just kind of look like they're, you know, chewing and not doing a whole lot. But emotionally, I think that there's more going on with sheep than many people give them credit for.
Dogs, too. A lot of dogs appear in your stories. And I'm wondering, what is it about dogs?
Yeah, they are. I mean, I think anyone who has dogs certainly wouldn't be that surprised to see them in these kinds of companionships, because they really, we know that dogs are bred to be companions. They want to be, generally, they want to be around people, they want to be praised, they want to have friends. And so to put them together with other animals, the stories are really wonderful and heartwarming, but they're a little less surprising maybe, because we know that dogs enjoy that sort of relationship and will seek it out. But it is funny when it's a dog and a cat, or something that you might not expect, a dog and a fish.
Yeah, that was, I was just about, I was thinking about that dog and a fish.
Yeah.
Because how can that little friendship happen? You relate
and, you know, calling it a friendship in that case, we might have been taking a little poetic license there, but it, you know, koi goldfish are, again, in the fish world, I would say that koi are quite smart. They certainly are gregarious. They will, if you have a fish pond, they will come over and be sociable in their own sort of fishy way. But in this case, it really, I think it stemmed from the curiosity on both animals' part. Perhaps initially the dog was kind of considering just pawing away at this little critter that was swimming beneath him, but eventually it became sort of a daily meeting for both of them, and the dog would run out to the pond, and the fish would swim over to the edge of the pond, and they would kind of have their little nose-to-nose few minutes before the day continued. And so just a lot of fun, not something you anticipate.
In looking at all your stories in your book, Unlikely Friendships, if you could sort of summarize, when do you tend to see these types of interspecies relationships? You know, when both parties have lost someone, or when it's babies wanting a parent?
Yeah, there is a component of loss, I think, in many of the stories, where you have circumstances where one animal, especially in the sort of the wilder situations, where an animal has lost a parent or been separated from a parent at a critical time in its development, and there may be either some confusion on the animal's part or a need to be parented, or in the other case, a need to be maternal or paternal for an animal that's lost its child or its baby, or its cub or its pup or whatever. So I do think that there is a little bit of a lesson, too, in terms of, again, especially in wild circumstances where you have this butting up against the wild by human development, and where you have cutting down of trees, and you have, putting farmland where forest used to be, there's going to be separation of animals from their families with poaching. There's, I think, a case or two in here where an animal was poached and left something behind. And so you see cases of unusual behavior because of an unusual context. And I think it's important to understand that as sweet and cute as it is to see, say, a lion playing or protecting its prey, there may be something deeper going on there that ultimately is not healthy for the big cat, because the big cat needs to be a predator and needs to know how to be a predator. And if it's lost the role model that it had, then that cat might not survive long term. But then there's also cases where, you know, people just have a lot of pets and they grow up together and they're just kind of like brothers and sisters, and it's almost as though they don't see the species difference. They don't know that a cat and a dog shouldn't get along, or that a bird and a cat shouldn't get along. And it just kind of works out, and in those situations it just makes you smile.
There was one story you told that was really interesting. Speaking of a bird and cat that normally wouldn't get along. I mean,
yes.
I do not think of birds and cats as best buds, but but you told a story about a cockatoo and a cat, and I was floored by that.
Yeah, and again, an interesting animal because, you know, those types of birds are, again, very intelligent and need a lot of entertaining in their lives. And in this case, the cat sort of became the entertainment, I think, for the bird. But yes, very unexpected for the owners to come in and find the bird, you know, sitting on the cat's head, or just a really fun relationship that they were completely floored by it and really just enjoyed watching it develop.
How did that even start? Because normally you'd try to separate the two, wouldn't you?
You would think so. I know, that could have gone terribly, terribly wrong. but they were lucky. In this case, I think that they had a situation where the bird was kind of allowed out. It was just a household where the animals sort of roam free a lot of the time. And they just, one of the owners just came upon the two together on the bed. I think they came into the room. They hadn't realized that the cat was in the room. Might have been under the bed or something like that, and the bird was allowed to roam free in the room, and so suddenly there they were together, completely unanticipated meeting, and pretty quickly they became affectionate housemates, and they would, you know, the bird would stick its tongue in the cat's ear. So there was definitely something going on there. they'll share the lap of the owner and sit there watching TV, and it's just a really apparently a very comfortable friendship.
Very interesting. You tell another few predator and prey type relationships, one with a bobcat kitten and a fawn.
Yes.
And both were victims of a fire, right?
Yes, there are, again, another bit of, on a sad note, there are problems when you have a natural disaster or, you know, any situation, again, where animals are abandoned. Hurricane Katrina would be another example where a lot of animals became strays, and I'm sure many, many animals died. But there were cases where animals sort of got together in need, I think, in need of a companion, in need of some sort of stress release because they were afraid and they were lost and really just didn't know what to do. And so the context, again, sort of allowed them to have a relationship that they might not otherwise have had.
One that was particularly strange was related to, of course, I'm going to always choose the weird ones, and I'm thinking of two, and I wanted to talk about each one, because these two happened in the wild, and one involved a leopard and a cow in India, and we've already talked about the cheetahs and the livestock, and so here you had a wild leopard befriending a cow. What happened there?
It is another of those situations where normally the leopard would probably be a danger to this cow. These are, you know, again, livestock that are out there and pretty easily plucked off by big cats. But this was a very, very strange situation that really, really surprised the people of the town and actually changed their opinion of leopards, which normally they saw as dangers. But this leopard just began coming to this place where the cow was chained up, and just showed up there one night and cuddled up with this cow. And it's just a really, really bizarre situation. The cow would lick the cat and, you know, sort of clean it, and they would sleep together. And then before the light of day, the leopard would creep away. And so it was almost like the leopard knew that something was wrong, unnatural about this, and yet needed this perhaps kind of parental instinct on the part of the cow. And again, this might be a situation where the leopard had lost a parent, or had lost, you know, was confused and uncertain, and in need of some kind of comfort or some kind of parental sort of relationship.
So you mentioned that villagers, it changed their opinion.
Yeah, they, first of all, I think they just were so amazed to see this, this animal that they sort of pictured as a bit of a monster creeping in to be affectionate with one of their animals. It was just such a surprise for them that I think some people just were kind of delighted by it. It changed the way they were looking at this cat. Also, I think that they believed that the cat was preying on wild pigs and jackals and other animals in the area that were hard on the crops, that were pulling out crops, eating their crops. So they saw a positive impact from having this leopard around, because it was taking out these animals that were doing damage to their land. So it's kind of a neat indirect benefit for the farmers there.
And did it mean that they wouldn't shoot leopards when they came into contact?
I think it, at least for a time, I think there was certainly a change in the people's behavior when big cats were in the area. They were more reluctant to treat them badly or to shoot them. Perhaps more shooting into the air rather than shooting at the cat would take place. So certainly a case like this was beneficial for leopards in general in that area.
What happened to that leopard and that cow?
Well, eventually the relationship just quietly ended. The cat came one night, and it had come for a number of nights in a row, and then it just disappeared, and that was the end of it. So I don't know if they had an argument or...
It was a forbidden relationship.
The leopard was sent away. This is the last time we're doing this. But no one knows. No one really knows what happened, and it just sort of adds to the mystery, and I think adds to the sort of inspiring nature of the whole thing.
And there was another relationship that you describe in your book, Unlikely Friendships, between a lion and an oryx.
Yes.
And local people said it was a message from God.
Yes, this was a big one. This occurred a while back, and actually there was a film made up about it, and it was really, it's a very classic sort of interspecies tale. But this was a lioness that, again, probably was confused between a maternal instinct and a predatory instinct, and she came upon a baby antelope, and instead of knocking this thing to the ground like she would normally do, she befriended it and became its protector. And they actually wandered together for quite a long time. Unfortunately, the cat stopped eating during this period, and almost was sort of more focused on protecting this animal than on taking care of herself. And sadly, the antelope was eventually taken by another lion. It's just a very, very sad story, really.
And the lioness responded by adopting more oryx?
Yes, the local people there had kind of been following this situation and, you know, kind of didn't know what to do. Should they step in? Should they feed the lioness, who was becoming thinner and weaker? Should they separate the animals? What should they do? They really wanted this relationship to last. They wanted to see where, you know, what would happen. And so when the young antelope was killed, I think they actually even did try to feed the lion and try to help her. And eventually she took on some other antelopes as her adoptees. But she also did go back to hunting for herself. So she did kind of flip a switch and figure out what she needed to do. So it was a very mixed up story, a really, really interesting combination of events.
So eventually she stopped befriending oryxes and maybe ate them. maybe not her own adopted oryx. But.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure at some point that does happen. They do kind of have to their wild instinct is going to kick in if they're hungry enough, and the story endings aren't always happy.
But it's important for her own survival.
Exactly.
Like you've been saying. That's,
yes. I mean, that is the natural way.
I'm wondering if you could tell me some of the interspecies relationships you've had in the wild, because there's this picture in your book, Unlikely
yes.
Friendships, of you like kissing a potato cod, which is this huge, huge fish.
The fish's breath was worse than mine, I have to say.
I mean, wow.
Yes.
Tell me about the background for that one.
I have faced off with some unusual animals, I must admit. I've had an encounter with a tiger shark as well that probably could have ended very badly, but fortunately didn't. But yeah, these fish are fairly tame in this area, off the Great Barrier Reef. I think a lot of divers go there, so they come around. So that probably wasn't a unique experience with that particular fish. Many others had probably kissed that fish before I did.
So he's sort of a flirt.
Yeah, definitely. I haven't really witnessed a whole lot of unusual kind of friendships, if we can call them that. There is one story at the back of the book that about, again, on the Great Barrier Reef, I did encounter a mix of fish that was unexpected and just kind of made you laugh, because it was this ridiculous large old puffer fish, just kind of a big softball, and it found its way into the center of a school of these lovely bright yellow what they're called, sweet lips. They're a type of grunt. And it was just a lot of fun to see this fish as though he belonged in the middle of this school. And he was there every day that I went diving in that area. And, you know, I don't really know why he was there. I suspect that there may have been a cleaner fish that came to that area, and perhaps he was just putting himself in the center of these fish to be a part of that that interaction, which is a different kind of interaction. That's kind of one of those mutualistic relationships that's easily explained. The cleaner fish gets to eat, and the fish that are being cleaned get clean. So it's kind of an easy matchup. But this was just, you know, I had never seen this combination, and he was just such a funny-looking, kind of old, tattered fish. And to see him seemingly very proudly in the middle of these other fish was quite amusing.
Now, of course, I have to ask you, since you mentioned this tiger shark,
yeah,
what was that encounter? Was that at the Great Barrier Reef as well?
That was not. That was in the Bahamas. For National Geographic, a number of years back, we did a story about sharks of the Bahamas, and sort of that areas around the Bahamas are kind of a special place for sharks. There's a lot of species there, and they seem to be thriving in many cases, where in other parts of the world they might not be doing as well. So we went in search of tiger sharks. There was an area that our captain knew about where there seemed to be a group that came up off the deeper water and sort of hung out in this relatively shallow area. And we spent a number of days diving with these sharks, and they were incredible. And we were right there with them. We weren't in cages or anything, and there was really no uncomfortable situation. I didn't feel great fear from them. They would swim right by me, and they really kind of look at you as they go by. You really felt like you sort of almost make a connection with them briefly as they check you out and you check them out. But the circumstance was basically that one kind of came up behind me, and I was busy sort of looking off into the distance, and the photographer who was with me kind of swam over really quick and kind of pushed me down out of the way, because she was clearly coming very close and kind of in a posture that looked like she might, let's say, nuzzle the back of my head. So I don't know that anything would have happened. She may have just moved on right by, but there was video of the moment, and I saw it, and I thought, ooh, you know, you have to be really, really careful out there. You can't get too comfortable with animals that that are that powerful and that could easily harm you. Without, you know, they're not looking at you and saying, "Oh, isn't that sweet? And what a nice person! And I'm not going to harm that person." They might be thinking, "I'm hungry, and what is that thing there?" So you do have to respect their power and their predatory instinct.
Did encounters like that feed into this book in any way, or how have your National Geographic experiences fed into this book?
I think my appreciation and love of animals in general has been heightened over time by all of the projects I've done for National Geographic. The experience of going out into the field and actually seeing animals in their natural habitat, and just getting to know, you know, the natural animal behavior, all of those things just make me want to know more about animals, to write more about animals, and to just experience as much of that as I can. And this book, while it kind of goes in a different direction, it's a little lighter and more fun than what I normally write about, it was just another perspective on animals and another way to see that they're not robots. They have, you know, the ability to have emotions that are probably very similar to what we have. And there's no reason to think that they can't, you know, cross boundaries and find companionship with animals unlike themselves, which we do all the time.
You had two, since we were talking about diving, mm-hmm. And you have two unlikely friendships that I found really interesting. One was about a diver and a manta ray, and another about a photographer and a 12-foot female leopard seal, which
yes.
I know in Antarctica. And I remember when this was published in National Geographic Kids, there was an article that my
yes.
son loved.
Uh-huh.
And I have to say, I just loved it. It was really interesting because normally, you know, how aggressive are leopard seals?
Very, very. They can be, especially a female. I mean, it was just so unusual, that whole encounter that Paul Nicklin, the photographer, had there. I think, you know, from his perspective, even though he's been exposed to so many wild animals, he, you know, photographs all kinds of really, really wild things in very, very wild places, animals that are not at all used to humans. And yet, for him, this was one of the most spectacular interactions he had ever had, because this animal could have just torn him apart. I mean, there was just no expectation on his part that there would be any kind of bond whatsoever between them. And here, this animal, not only did she tolerate him, she attempted to feed him as though he were her pup, and seemed to, as he described it, to get frustrated with him for not being a good hunter on his own and for not participating in this meal with her. And just a really, really, really remarkable exchange. And I'm sure it was
because
really
she was even bringing him penguins.
Yes, yes.
To eat.
She was trying to teach him how to catch a penguin. She would bring a live one over and sort of toss it at him, and it would swim away. And he said she would just kind of blow bubbles as though she were exasperated with him for not chasing the penguin, because obviously he stayed still and didn't want to do anything that, you know, he tries to stay out of their space as much as he can, and it doesn't want to affect their behavior too much. But of course his presence there does affect their behavior on some level. And in this case, it brought out the very best, I think, in this very, you know, potentially dangerous animal.
And why? Why? I mean, you read that and you're like, aha! Because you would think that the leopard seal would have just as soon eat him as feed him.
That one is a complete mystery to me, absolute mystery. That's just one of those things that, again, shows you that animals don't always do what you expect them to do, and they're not just, you know, a predator is not just a predator. A predator is going to respond to different circumstances, different ways. And for whatever reason, in this case, it was to be to act like a mother to this rather slow-moving, large, shiny-faced man with his camera. And it just sort of manifested into this interesting friendship.
Wow. And the manta ray, that was interesting.
Yeah. Again, a situation where a diver encounters an animal that seems to want to play, seems to want to be with him, and he even was trying to get away from the animal because he was supposed to be working underwater doing photography. photography of some other animals, and the ray wouldn't leave him alone. It just kept getting underneath him. It physically, you know, it wanted to be touched, and his intention was not to touch it again, to sort of stay back from the wild animals that they were observing. But she wouldn't allow that. She wanted to be under his hands, and she would sort of find her way underneath him and kind of rub up against him almost like a cat. And he had this incredible sort of dance with this incredible animal. And, you know, he eventually had to be the one to pull away and say enough. And she, almost as if she watched him kind of swim toward the surface. And if she could have waved goodbye, maybe she would have. I don't know.
Maybe she did with her fin.
Yeah, exactly. But again, just the, you know, so inspiring, and to be in a wild situation and have an animal show interest in you, is, it just hits you on a level that is very hard to explain. It really, if you're an animal lover in any way, there's nothing quite like that moment of having that animal respond to you.
Now, were there stories that you had found out about but didn't make it into the book?
Yes, the book ended up with 47 stories, and I think that at the peak, I was pursuing about 90. It was a logistical challenge, let's say, to keep it all straight, because all the stories were at different points in reporting, and, you know, could we get a photograph, and what were the rights to the photograph, and there were a lot of steps to get each story to the point of actually being in the book. There were some where the ending wasn't too happy, and so we decided maybe, you know, that wasn't the best case to include. There's some very cute pictures of a leopard with a mouse, and for some period of time the leopard and the mouse kind of coexisted in the exhibit at the zoo, and there seemed to be kind of an acceptance. The mouse would eat from the cat's bowl, and the cat would kind of bat the mouse around, but not in an aggressive manner. They kind of hung out together. But when I interviewed the photographer, I kind of pushed him to tell me what finally happened, and he didn't really want to say, so I decided that maybe, you know, likely that didn't end well for the mouse, and I decided maybe that wasn't going to be the best story to include. There was a wonderful story that, unfortunately, due to some photo licensing rights, we weren't able to include it, but there was a case with some scientists working off of Hawaii. They observed a dolphin and a humpback whale that had an incredible encounter, where the dolphin seemed to be soliciting play behavior from the whale, and the whale literally was lifting the dolphin out of the water, and the dolphin would sort of slide down the rostrum of the whale.
No way!
Back in the water. It's just incredible. And they had an amazing picture of it, and unfortunately it's not in the book, but just, you know, again, in the wild, completely, you know, there was not any kind of human interaction with these animals. And so they were doing this completely on their own, and it happened again and again. It wasn't just sort of a weird one-time thing. And it certainly seemed to the scientists on board the boat that this was play. The dolphin wanted to experience this sort of being flung out of the water. It was like a dad, you know, throwing his little girl in the pool. And it just an amazing, amazing interaction that must have been really incredible to see in person.
Wow.
Yeah. And, of course, the stories keep coming in. People keep sending them to me. I'm like, stop, I don't know, it's too late.
Well, maybe, maybe book two.
There might have to be a book two. And, you know, the fact that I included just those two people-animal interactions, I threw those in because they were just so wonderful, and I really wanted to use them, but certainly that could be a book. There's so many of those, people who encounter animals in unexpected circumstances and have some kind of short-term relationship of some kind with that animal. I think it would be a lot of fun to collect those stories next.
One that is so famous that you do include in your book that we haven't actually talked about, that I'd probably be remiss in not asking you about, would be about Coco, the gorilla.
There's something about primates hugging kittens that I think is so familiar to us that those stories just become, you know, huge hits. people just love to see that, because here's this huge beast that literally could crush the kitten in one hand, and you know, instead literally hugging it and petting it and playing with it just as, you know, as we would. And again, it's just, I think that there's this familiarity with those kinds of stories, and there's a number of primate kitten stories. I think there might be 3 of them in the book, because I think that that's just not a terribly uncommon combination in a zoo setting, especially. These primates want a pet, just as I like having a pet. The gorilla wants a pet, the orangutan wants a pet, and kittens are pretty tolerant, and that just seems to work out very well for them.
One weird pet that somebody had that you talk about is Humphrey the pet hippopotamus.
Yes.
Now, first of all, my question there was, why does someone have a pet hippo?
Yeah. I think there's more of that kind of thing going on out there than we might think. Keeping animals that you know, I'm not sure they in most normal settings would work. But
and this case was interesting because it was a Cameroonian mountain goat, also called a pygmy goat.
Right.
And Humphrey, the pet hippopotamus. And in this case, what made me chuckle is that in this case, the goat wasn't really a very good role model.
Not at all.
Sort of a delinquent goat.
The goat was sort of the bad, you know, the bad sibling that always gets into trouble and is a really not a good role model at all, and was almost teaching this hippopotamus to get into trouble along with the goat. So it was, you know, again, I'm not sure what to make of it exactly, but there did seem to be some imitation on the part of the hippo. These Cameroonian mountain goats are very good. I think I say in the book they're really good escape artists. They're good climbers. They're just mischievous in a way. And, you know, a hippo you wouldn't sort of expect to follow that kind of lead. And yet in this case...
No, especially because there's so much bigger... Like, when I think of a goat, I think of very agile and you know, able to climb. When I think of a hippo, I do not think of
not
those
so
same
much.
Attributes.
Yeah, I mean, this was, you know, I think this hippo already, you know, had kind of a bad behavior streak in it, and so perhaps following along wasn't too unexpected. But yeah, I don't think that the hippo was able to climb and hop and jump in the way that the goat was, but it still managed to get into a lot of trouble. But the hippo, you know, I think the hippo needed that companionship, and ultimately I think for the health of the animal, despite this all happening, it was good for. I keep saying him, but it turned out that the hippopotamus was a she.
Oh, really?
They didn't know that at the time of the relationship. So yeah, lots of interesting stuff came out of that story. Unexpected.
Why do you think that these animals have all of these emotions? You've talked a lot about emotions and the need for these relationships. And is there some sort of physical basis for these relationships? And is it similar to humans' need for relationships?
I think it is. I think that this is something that for a long time was not accepted in the scientific community at all. And actually, I think scientists who, you know, suggested that animals had similar emotions to humans were kind of looked down upon and criticized for that. But I think that as more research is done and as we understand physiologically animals better, we see that they, you know, we really share a lot with them. There's obviously the DNA connection. We have so much of the same genes as our animal companions. But also just in terms of the systems of the body, we share the limbic system with other mammals, and that's where the root of emotion is. And so I think it's important to say that we don't know that, say, a dog or a cheetah is going to have the same kind of emotion, that they're going to experience it in the exact same way as a human. But I think there's no reason to assume that they don't have something very similar, and that they, in terms of companionship, it makes a lot of sense that animals have needs that are very similar to humans.
So when someone reads your book, Unlikely Friendships, what would you want them to take away from all this? What do these unlikely friendships tell us about the animal world?
Well, I think the first thing I'd sort of want them to get from it is just a positive experience, just a kind of a warming experience. I think these kinds of stories really hit us on an instinctive level. Anyone who has any sort of love for animals at all, just it's hard to look at these pictures and not feel sort of a sense of, I want to say awe, but I want to say awe, because I think that's more what I have in mind. It's just really wonderful. They're kind of delightful. The photographs are delightful, and the relationships are. So on the first, the first point would be just that there's joy in this book, and I want people to take that away. But I also think there are other things that can be found in it, and one of those is that animals are capable of having emotion, are capable of having companions, relationships. They're not robots. They don't always respond the way you would expect, and they have a need for companionship in many circumstances. And if their world changes and is turned upside down, they may seek that out in an unexpected way. And then in the bigger picture, when we're talking about conservation and destruction of habitat and the overlap of humans and wild animals, again, we need to look at animals as something more than just, these things that we rule over in some way, or that are expendable, or that, well, they don't feel anything anyway, so it doesn't matter if the elephant is separated from the herd. It does matter, and it matters very much. And I think it's a lesson for us to treat animals in a certain way, and also to take away that, we should be treating each other in the way that we see these animals treating each other. There's really just kind of an inspiring note to it as well.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about interspecies relationships with Jennifer Holland, senior writer for National Geographic magazine and author of the new book, Unlikely Friendships.
Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Wildlife can also be heard on the AnimalWise Radio Network, which is available nationally and internationally and is broadcast to any mobile internet device via Live 365, a 24/7 radio network. Of course, if you have any comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.